You have reached a phone call from Paul, a Literary Hub podcast. To hear more, visit lithub.com. Part 2 of Paul Holden Graber's conversation with Eric Jarosinski.
I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here, but when you're speaking about classical rhetoric, does an example come to mind to you of a tweet of yours that you think particularly responds to classical rhetoric and to a form of concision, or am I asking you to remember something that you can't recall?
Well, I actually don't remember my own tweets, but I would say that something that is part of the Afra's tools of the trade is always working with certain inversions. That's one of the kind of oldest tricks in the book. And I think that something I wrote once, trying to address my own overuse of that, was the inversion of cliché or the cliché of inversion?
Right.
That's very much what it felt like I was doing after a while. And I've actually tried to avoid that since it became clear to me how much I was beating that particular dead horse in terms of form. But those are still things that are effective and that people respond to. And it is sort of the elegance of it and the fact that a short text that also feels like it has a real beginning and end in a way. It has, you feel like you've gone somewhere in this little circus act of inversion in a short sentence. It's almost, you know, a gymnast sticking a perfect landing somehow. After the bit of twirling, you know, in terms of substituting terms here and there.
And in some way, you know, the short attention span, which is so bemoaned by everybody, and which probably Twitter for many people contributes in enhancing in some way, what you're saying, which is surprisingly hopeful, is that people are actually paying attention to tweets because they are, if successful, beautifully constructed and may give people the kind of tingle in your spine that Nabokov felt great literature should do, because in some way they are, in terms of form, beautifully constructed. So they are, in a way, Twitter can be an education.
Yeah, I think in some ways that's true. I mean, it's been an education for me, certainly, in the sense of as again, what I consider honing a craft of some sort. But also, you know, I don't think people are necessarily conscious of, you know, why they happen to like one thing versus another. I think the thing that people mainly respond to on Twitter and respond to in a way that you could see in terms of, you know, they push that star button, or which I guess is a heart now, or they retweet the thing. It's a very immediate response, if it happens at all. And usually I think that response is driven by some sense of that's true, or yes, or I agree, or someone also sees the world I do, but they've been able to formulate it.
And you know, in that way, it's a release in the same way as... in the same way as many things, but in the same way I'm thinking particularly, a joke is.
Mm-hmm.
When you read a tweet and it works for you, you've sort of gotten the punchline.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, I would say that the things that I write for Twitter now are really much closer to jokes than the aphorism tradition. I think that what it is, I tried to formulate that also once, something like, yes, there's a difference between the joke and an aphorism, or there's a line separating the joke from the aphorism, the secret is to cross it. And for me, I think that's very much how I see Twitter now, is that it's for a certain type of writing, a certain rhythm, the kind of explosive punchline sort of thing. Whereas what I'm doing for print, for this newspaper, or for the book, that's read a little different way. It's more of a meandering path, and the response is not that visceral. It's there isn't the same kind of sense of release that comes at the end. It's I think the best I can get with that, and it's okay with me because it's written this way. It's more a sense of interesting, or yes, or okay. You could also see it. You know, it's a very different response. Kind of the response to, you know, a good cartoon that might not make you laugh out loud, but that you appreciate it. Appreciate what it has to say and how it says it.
Yeah, in a very interesting piece in The New Yorker called The Construction of a Twitter Aesthetic, which is a profile of your Twitter feed and of your work, there's actually mention of Gary Larson and how maybe those cartoons matter to you. And I remember one Gary Larson cartoon which I adore, where you see a family looking at the corner of a room. It's about four or five people in a family, and they're looking at the corner of the room, and that's all you see. And the text is, "The days before the television."
Yeah, that's nice. Well, I mean, I have to say, what I remember, and I don't know if Gary Larson himself said this or someone said it talking about his work, is that much of the secret to it was that you laugh at it because you think of what comes next.
That's right.
Not what's pictured, but what comes next.
That's right.
You don't have that there, but you have the setup. And that's, for me, what I've thought about in terms of tweets in particular, is this idea of cartoons without pictures. And in terms of the genre, to me, I try to think of them sort of as textual cartoons. And
Well, that might be a good tagline.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the thing right now, because the work I'm most interested in is this newspaper stuff, because it's taking a voice and a style developed on Twitter, but in a different medium, and using it to comment on things going on in the world right now. That's why, you know, as I said this morning, I spent most of the day following news, is that I'm looking for sort of the talking points, the catchphrases, the cliches that are being bandied about, because I want to take exactly those terms and see what I can do with them. Ways in which I can kind of unpack them or rearrange them or do something interesting. Also, in a way that's in a form that's just as brief as sort of the political slogan itself. That to me is the fun of it. And that's why I think of it having the function of, you know, what we think of as a classic sort of political cartoon, but working at the level of text language.
I was going to ask you, is there serious intent there? Because, you know, the New Yorker piece speaks about an aesthetic, and I often, when I read your tweets, I feel I'm also reading something that is politically and ethically minded, and maybe debunking the clichés, if you put it in kind of a Flaubert tradition.
Yeah, well, no, that is definitely the case. I mean, but at the same time, I guess the trick for me is, I mean, I don't think I've ever written something that I don't somehow believe in. I'm not saying anything ever just for the sake of the form or for the sake of playing a character. But I'm not interested in kind of adopting a kind of self-righteous position and commenting on anything. I like always to be able to say something while also making it clear that the authority of that statement is very much up to question. That's why the joke form speaks to me so much. When you hear a joke, there's a certain type of truth you might find in it, but it's not anything you would ever bring as evidence, you know, or something you could point to as somehow supporting an argument, for instance. And so I would say, yeah, there's always some intent there, but it is the task, at least the goal that I have, that there are plenty of times when it's not particularly clear to someone, especially when I'm commenting on some, you know, event in German political news of the last week, exactly where I would stand on a particular issue, but I'm drawing attention to something that stands out to me about it.
But you see, for instance, with the Oscars having happened recently, I very much liked this tweet you had, which reads as follows: "Yes, friends, the Oscars tonight. A gentle reminder to thank the industry for culture."
Well, I really like how you read these. You read them very much in the way that they sound in my head, but I can't do myself. Well, that's always something I find interesting about that context is, the culture industry is something I've taught for many years in different forms, because the Frankfurt School, the work of Adorno, Benjamin, others, is one of the things that has interested me most. And these award shows, always fascinating, because you have the language of industry and the language of artistry at the same time in this kind of interesting coexistence. And that's simply all that is. To me, it was fascinating to watch. I was really curious to see how Chris Rock would do this. I think he did a great job, because what I'm doing is not the work of a comedian, but when I'm traveling around and doing these shows, it does have some similarities to that. So I was really interested in seeing how he'd handle this sort of high pressure, charged situation. I think he was perfect.
I think he did very, very well as well. I must say it was a very hard job to have for him, but I think he did it very graciously, and I very much liked what he had to say about someone like Paul Giamatti as well. I thought that was, right, you know, really, really well put. So these tours you do, what are they exactly?
I suppose you could say it's sort of a reading tour. Now that I actually have a book, I was doing it though for the first year or so without anything to sell. Essentially put out the call on Twitter, invite me, I'll come to your town, get a space, if you can put me up for the night and give me a few bucks for doing it, I'm happy to come. Largely what I, initially did was sort of, talked a bit about really the only thing I know about at the moment, which is my own work. I'm not an expert on the internet or on social media in particular. But I try to the extent I can, draw on what it is that I learned from this Nine project. And often that's helpful to other people, especially to academics who are interested in social media, interested in some sort of outreach, interested in how you translate the kind of specialization that you've developed in your research into a language that others can engage with, and so on. And that's a lot of what I've done has been that. The new challenge for me that I've taken on is I try now to spend the first, third or so of what I'm doing, the show, talking about things that are happening in that particular city or at that particular university, and I often have very little time to prepare, and that's the fun challenge of it. And usually I'm always kind of playing this character of the idiot who stumbled in, who misinterprets everything, but in misinterpreting it, you essentially are issuing some critical reading of the place where you are.
It's really interesting, because in a way you have espoused the role that the poet had towards the king. Give me home and some food, and I will entertain you with my poetry.
Well, it's a little bit what it's like, yeah. The fun thing for me also, though, has been often the people who invite me, they're often connected to sort of an activist community that's got issues that they want some attention brought to, and if there's things that I want to support, I'm happy to do that. And they don't get a giant audience for my being there, but they often often get, you know, more than they had otherwise.
Do you feel that a lot of the people who come and see you in are disenfranchised intellectuals as well, or academics who just can't really bear being in the academy anymore?
Well, it's a real mixture of people. I'm happy that it's not all academics or former academics. I could certainly also, in what I write about, I've tried to move away from specifically academic stuff to a great extent, for various reasons. It's just not as close to my life anymore, and also I just find that too limiting. I'd rather be able to comment about whatever it is I want to talk about. But I would say that that's a big chunk of the audience is that often graduate students or undergraduates are considering graduate school. And it's interesting because they always frequently they have questions about going on to get a PhD, and they will ask me about it always with this kind of preface about how I'm certainly not going to encourage this, but they're thinking about going on to get a PhD in philosophy or literature or something. But that actually isn't my position at all. It's really much more one of I very much encourage that, but my advice is always just not to lose sight of everything else that's going on in the world. Don't let your world become as small as your PhD program, and you'll have a better time of it, and you'll be a better professor at the end of it. But but for me, I would say that there are those any number of people who, and these are the people who normally might, you know, talk to you at the end of a show. They've had a similar experience. They've either been grad students and didn't stick with their program, or they were in the academy for a while as professors and got out of it. Or others were simply still in it and say, you know, I respect what you're doing. And that means a lot to me, because there have been times when I've gone places and someone said, oh yeah, you're the guy with that anti-intellectual blog or anti-academic blog or something. And that's not how I see what I do.
Goodness, that would make me feel that the people who are saying this to you are really very poor readers.
I don't know about that. I'm not sure. I mean, but that is part of it, though, because the other thing is that oftentimes what sticks with people is just sort of the exaggerated quality of the negative in what I'm doing. Because, you know, I'm always working with exaggeration, as any graphic cartoonist would do. That's what a textual cartoonist does as well. I mean, you're
emphatic
in certain aspects. And one of them for me is sort of the darkness, the despair, the hopelessness that people will associate with something like German philosophy, not without reason. But my hope is always that there's a tension there between, say, the darkest of sentiments and the joy in the formulation of how it's being said. And I think that's, you know, one of the many contradictions that you can have at work for you in a short text.
You know, as you're speaking, I'm reminded of this wonderful quotation I so love of Kafka, where he said, "There's hope, but not for us."
yeah, that's outstanding. Those are the moments for me. I mean, I learned that from one of my professors in graduate school, and those are the things I'll never forget. Where to me there's so much packed into that. But why it sticks with me is in the sheer pleasure of that formulation.
It's so wonderful, isn't it? And you know, for me, beyond all the things that I do learn, and I want to stress that I learn things by reading your Twitter account, Nine Quarterly, which I really encourage everybody to look at, because they will I think, it'll be very interesting to see how various people who may not know it up to now will react. But one of the things that I learn a lot of is the day that people have died 10, 20, 50, 200, 300 years ago. There is I don't know how you call it, a hashtag, I think you say, on this day someone died. I don't think that's exactly the hashtag, but yesterday it was Montaigne's death day or birthday, or on this day born. And there was this wonderful line that I had forgotten, that I adore of Montaigne and that I espouse deeply, where he says, I quote others only in order to better express myself. I mean, it doesn't get better. I mean, and it's just, and there's a lot to learn from just reading that. Or another line that was that I did remember, and which matters, of course, incredibly to me, is another line by Montaigne where he says that the most fruitful and natural exercise for our minds, in my opinion, is conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I mean, I have a certain ambivalence about all this at the same time, though, because while I appreciate that, I can appreciate the sentiment, and realize there's a lot of living and there's a lot of experience that's crystallized in those formulations. For me, though, in terms of engaging with the kind of classical tradition of the aphorism, there's that note of the kind of maxim-like authority in some of those things that I also kind of try to stay away from. That what I'm often trying to do is say, well, you know this already, but let me say this about it anyhow.
Right.
Or why one of the things that I often do when I'm writing, and doing this from the very beginning, is setting up whatever I'm writing with a gentle reminder about something. And it, usually if you subtract that, a gentle reminder, then you've got some sort of traditional sort of maxim, proverb-ish like formulation. But to me, it's important to establish the fact that this is something that's being said with a certain tone of authority, but at the same time, it's not necessarily claiming that authority.
So in a way, you're trying to get away from the sanctimonious.
Definitely, yeah, definitely I am. Because if there's one thing that motivated what I do, it's not some idea of popularizing difficult ideas or making them easier or teaching someone anything. It's mainly about demystifying in some form of making it clear that you, in some ways, you might show the greatest respect towards a critical thinker or a radical thinker by, in a way, being irreverent with their work. By having a type of what I often consider sort of a respectful irreverence towards their work, because that's often what I missed as an academic, in the type of how would I put it? Almost to use the Benjaminian term, sort of aura surrounding someone like a Walter Benjamin, irony of ironies, in terms of their position within the academy and so on, that often people find intimidating to the extent that they will never meaningfully engage with a number of these thinkers because they're scared off by it from the outset. And there are those that I've seen too many times as a professor in a seminar who kind of use their greater knowledge of some of these figures as a type of weapon, in the sense of, well, you haven't read enough Lacan to comment on this the way I can, etc. And that's something that I found very discouraging, and one of the main things I guess I've tried to work against is in whatever form I can, make it clear there can be something in these difficult ideas for you, and they're there for you as much as they are for anybody else.
And
they're gonna be easy.
Right, and in a way, approach them with critical acumen and also with kind of a joyful irreverence.
That's the hope. I mean, that is the hope. I mean, that's what I was able to do in teaching, I found, over time. I didn't, not initially, but over time. I could never quite find that in writing, and that was that was sort of my downfall. The few things that I actually finished writing, I have quite a collection of half-written essays. the ones that I did finish were ones that had a joke somewhere in the first couple of pages, and that's what made it possible for me. But it was hard ever to get to that point, because that whole part of myself was very much shut off when I was sitting at my laptop trying to do the serious writing of serious scholarship. I just never carved out that space for myself to do that. I wish I could have, but I never quite managed it.
Eric, on this note of hopefulness, I'd like to really thank you for taking my call, this call from Paul, and I hope that it if not made you feel better about the phone, it wasn't too much of a painful exercise.
No, not at all, and it was truly lovely hearing you reading my work.
Well, maybe we could encourage Audible to hire me to read your tweets. That would be something quite wonderful to do. People could read it, you know, in bed late at night, hear it in bed late at night, and maybe it could give them all kinds of new dreams or nightmares.
I can only assume.
So. All the best to you. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Paul.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.